was a kid and going to school, our football field was down for in that area where the plaza is, town plaza.
City Market.
And Craigers
okay.
is.
Okay.
It's down in that area, and I don't remember just exactly where it was, but it was mm-hmm. in that area someplace, and that was our high school football field.
Oh.
But the greedy fathers now, the greedy Durango fathers, they wanted that property. It was too valuable. It was Durango had been the world. And Durango at that time was 4,000 or 5,000 people. The city limits was 3 blocks this side of the fairgrounds.
Oh.
You know. In
20th Street.
Around that, I don't know just what about. Well, Brookside was the end of the city limits.
Oh.
So anyway, they bought the property from the school down there because it was valuable. And so then they put, and Durango has no right to that, they put the school football field and the school baseball field in the fairgrounds. And to do that, they had to cut the fairgrounds down. You know, the rodeo stands and stuff, they cut it down. We used to have a rodeo back in those days called Spanish Trail Fiesta. And we had good rodeos. But they cut it down so much by putting that field and the baseball field in there, it was cut down so small the cowboys wouldn't come here because they couldn't even get out of the chute before they was to the fence line. They had no room, so the cowboys couldn't come here. And then they ruined the fairground. And that football field and baseball field was still in the fairgrounds, and that don't belong to Durango.
So now they're talking about putting it out in the county where they'll have all the room in the world.
All the world they want. But that Durango high school and put their football field and stuff in the room, and they shouldn't have. Bayfield has to build their field. Ignacio has to build theirs. And, you know, all these other schools have to build their
did
fields.
Did you play in sports when you
yes.
were in high school here? Football or what?
I played football, and I was on the track team. And I was an acrobat.
And an acrobat.
Gymnast, or whatever you want to call it. We call it tumbling in those days.
Oh.
It was not as good as it is today.
Would you tell us that story that you told me earlier about when you were a kid, you could stand on your hands and what else could you do? Walk on your hands, stand on your head, and how your grandfather...
I think we did, didn't we?
Did we tell that?
I think so.
No, I think you just told it to me. Tell it again anyway, just in case.
Yeah. If I didn't put it on there, I'm going to say, tell her again about my grandfather being here to visit me when I was a little kid, 7 or 8 years old maybe, and he was in his 80s with a long white beard that went clear to his waist. I'm out there showing off.
You said it had finger waves in
yeah.
his beard.
Real close, baby. And so we out there, and I'm showing off because I thought I was pretty smart. I was standing on my head and walking on my hands and stuff, and he let me do all that. When I got tired, why, he walked out in the yard and took his head down on the ground and threw his feet up in the air, and then he raised himself up and took off across the yard.
Oh, at 86 or something?
At 80-some years old, and I thought, Jesus, and I thought I was sharp.
He was telling you about being a show-off, right?
But,
well, did he show you any other tricks?
No, he just did that to kind of take the wind out of my sails, I suppose. But he was a nice man, friendly, and stuff. I was a tumbler in school, and I was pretty sharp.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they'd had the stuff that they've got today, that I could have probably done something with it, because I even after when I was little, I had a fine arts contest at the theater. Pops Theaters put it on. You run for a long time, and they take winners from one area, and you could stay in there as long as you could come up with an act. Another kid and I entered that with a tumbling act that we had made up on our own. And we went clear to the finals and won the finals in Denver with our little act. So if we was that good at that time, with nobody to teach us, just on what our own abilities and what we tried to do, think of something and then try to do it, right? Now they teach them.
Almost like a circus act.
Yeah. That's what it demands.
Sure.
We want to stay champs. And that one night's contest.
Well, when you think about Durango in those days, I mean, can you remember the first car and the first, and did you travel on horseback and buggies and how much of that can you remember?
I can remember quite a bit about it. My mother worked for Wood & Morgan, which later became Wood & Morgan Burnett.
What
it was
they
a construction company.
Construction.
When I was little, it was Wood & Morgan, and they had nothing but teams. Burnett come along and younger, and he's the one that modernized Wood & Morgan. And they started in the mechanical part of it. But up until Burnett come in, it was all teams. They had to move camp at their construction jobs, you know. You could only work so much. And then they'd have to set up another camp down farther with another little section. And my mother cooked for them as a cook on these jobs. I'm a little kid, 7 or 8 years old, and Wood & Morgan had a little paint horse that they gave me to ride, and they gave me a job. My job was riding up and down the construction site with a lot of dust, canvas bags of water on my saddle horn, giving those teamsters a drink of water.
Oh.
Back and forth all day long. They're in water, those teamsters. So they could work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of interesting. And Burnett joined up with them, and then they started going clinical. But I remember they helped build that road from West Virginia down to the rock. That used to be the highway. Other highways, new, modern things. The old highway went up through Wildcat Canyon. Go through Mason, the little investors.
Is that the same Burnett construction that's here today?
Well,
or part of,
no, it's
part of the family.
They kept the name and stuff because of the PUC number. That's the oldest PUC number in the state of Colorado.
Oh.
It's secret now.
PUC.
It's a
license.
It's a license to contracting license for construction ordinance. That's the oldest one in the state of Colorado.
Hmm.
And that's when Secret bought it. Now Secret stands. Burnett is dead.
Oh.
I can tell you more, but I don't put it on tape. But he was a nice fellow. He died, and they sold out to Seekers more than that. The only reason he bought it, he was a bigger contractor than Burnett was. The only reason he bought it, he wanted that. He was seen it. That's Mr. Seekers.
Well, tell us about your own family.
Growing up here, I told you about where the football field was and everything. Then I get a little older and get to high school. My oldest brother, they went to school here, quite a bit older than I was, maybe 10, 12 years old. But he graduated from high school. All of us, most of us did. But he was the oldest one. And his name, everybody called him Doc. His name was Eugene Wesley. Everybody called him Doc, and he died with that name, Doc. It's in the school end. But when he was going to school, he was Mr. High School. He was the best football player, captain of the football team. He was president of the class. He was editor-in-chief of the school annual, and he had leading all the school plays.
Oh, my.
He was just Mr. High School. That's all on record. It's easy to trace. Because I come along my mischievous. But I learned all my mischievousness from my older brothers.
Oh.
So I'm the youngest, so this one does a little, something a little sneaky. So then he tells the next one, and the next one, he does that, and then he does something. And by the time I come along, I get them all right quick. I'm not mean, but I'm full of it. And I learned it from my big brothers.
Uh-huh.
So I was popular. I never had but one teacher in my life that I didn't like, and I only had one teacher that didn't like me, and it's the same one. But I had a reason to dislike him. I know he had a reason to dislike me or not, but he didn't. But that's the only one. I loved every one of my teachers, and I think every teacher I ever had loved me. And I know some of them did.
So you enjoyed school?
Oh, very much. Okay. I played football when I was in school, when I could. And I was on the track team because I was fast, like a deer. In fact, that's the reason I was able to play football, because we had a good football ball carrier that had a lot of speed. But he had such short legs, it took him a second to get started. But his little old short legs, his name was Jesse Markham. And I think he's the best high school football player that Granger has ever had. I still think so. I've never seen his equal. His hips hit me clear down halfway between my knees and hips. And little old short legs like this, long back, long neck, little tiny head, you know. But he could run 100 in 10-1, 10-2 in the football field. And I'm the only one that could keep up with him or run him. I'd win one time, he'd win another. So much shorter than mine. So you can imagine how fast those little legs were churning to get up that speed. And if he could, that was my sole job, was to get one man down so he could get those wheels spinning. And he was gone. That's the only reason I got to play, because I was too little. I was on the tunnel team. That was, we had a lot of demonstrations then. And then I had a count on my acrobatics and stuff. But I got in trouble when I was about 15. And I'm not going to mention names, but my mother was married to a fellow who was pretty mean. He was constantly beating her up. I'm not going to mention names. So he was constantly beating her up. One of my older brothers went to him about it. He ran him off with a gun. Of course, I'm just a little smart-headed kid, 14, 15 years old at the time. I went to him. I never lived with him. My oldest brother raised me. My brother ran him off. He had enough sense to leave. And I was a smart-headed kid, you know. I told him that if he ever did it again, I'd kill him. You know, I was a smart-headed kid who would talk. And sure enough, he did. I was working with Mason Andrews grocery store at the time. And it used to be on the 10th and Main. That was the biggest store in the county at the time. And I worked at Mason Andrews and had a room upstairs. Keeping room. One room and a bed and a little store that he used to. I lived there and worked there in the store. My mother come in the store with her eyes swelled shut with another lady brother in there. Her husband beat her up again. And I took off my apron and went after him. I broke in his house. And that's made me illegal to sit up. Because I went after him. I was too young and senseless to be afraid, didn't know what fear was. And I've got scars all over my body. I can show those scars to anybody that's interested. But he beat me up terribly. And I finally got him down. Finally, I'm only about 15 or 16. He was a man that was over 6 foot tall, he could have turned me over his knee and skinned me. You know, but he didn't. He was mean. He wanted to hurt me. Of course, I wanted to hurt him, naturally. I don't deny that I was wrong, but he was too. He hit me on the head here with a hammer. He didn't knock me out any other time, but it was fear that kept me on my feet. I know today why I didn't pass out. But, I didn't then. It scared the living devil out of me. But I'm fighting for my life. And when he hit me in the mouth and knocked my 4.2 down and threw his out with a hammer, I got the hammer and threw it away, and he grabbed one of those full stroke hookers, full of pokers, with a hook on the end of it. Put me across the arm and got a scar across the throat. He went through the bone. I got scars all over. But anyway, we got in a pretty good brawl, and I'm scared. It's the only reason I can remember this going. And I remember that grabbing that poker, and I'm holding that poker in front of me, and he takes back me on the back of the neck. And I'm hanging on for dear life, and he's trying to get away from him, and I got stooped clear over where I couldn't go any lower. You know, and I didn't know what to do, and I'm scared. So I finally dodged my head, hit him in the face with your head. Swung my head back up, and I caught him right in the nose, and knocked him dizzy. And he turned loose of that poker. And the minute he turned loose of the poker, I threw it away and turned around and kicked. And I kicked him. Or I shouldn't. Or should have,
yeah.
I guess. I kicked him the right place anyway.
Yeah.
And he went down. And I honestly can tell you, I don't know. Only what I learned in Detroit. And if they'd have waited probably another 5 minutes, I would have killed him. Because Ed Brennan.
Somebody came in then?
Ed Brennan, brother to Commissioner and Vice brother-in-law, her husband's brother, Ed Brennan. He happened to go by and thought it looked pretty rough. He went walk by a tree or two. Thought he was just stuck in the plate. It got a little dark when the light was on. He stopped and came back the last time. Thought, well, that's more than a scuffle. So he come in, and I had got the old man down then, and I was standing there just stumped. He got me off, shoved me out the door, and he said,
how old was the stepfather at that point?
He was 60.
He wasn't too old.
But I'm not going to mention names on this because it'll be listened to by several people.
Sure.
There's people here that I don't hurt that helped me through the trial.
Sure.
Testified for me. Mm-hmm. His own family.
Yeah. Well, that was a shame, but you were only protecting your mother and yourself.
Yeah, but legally I'm wrong. And the way they decided it, they finally let me out. First, they was going to send me to reform school. And I'm in jail. See, because I'm not in jail, actually. I was sent living with the jailer and his wife in the courthouse.
Oh.
They didn't lock me up in a cell, but I was confined.
Yeah.
And I couldn't go to school.
Restrained, yeah.
And I was restrained there for 5 months, waiting to see whether he was going to live or not. He darn near died. He was never able to hurt anybody else. He had to take out 2 weeks and all of his works. he wasn't much good anymore.
Mm.
But I'm not proud of it, but I'm not ashamed of it.
No.
I was ashamed when I first got out of it.
Your mother must have been horrified.
He left him, but the damage is done. I'm ashamed to go back to school because at that time, if you got thrown in jail, it was bad. I just couldn't face the kids in school anymore. The day that they had the trial and they exonerated me, I was gone the next morning.
Oh.
Grab a freight train.
Counselor helping
you
through that.
But I grew up here. I remember going to school in Adams City one winter, which they wouldn't allow today. But we were so poor at that time that I didn't have any shoes. I'm going to school all the way. That's hard to believe. But, they wouldn't allow it. That was before my brother. My mother was having a hard time for when I was 6 months. That's when my brother came back and took over the family. He was just a kid himself. He was only 16 or 18 years old at the time. He came back and he became my father, my brother, and friend, and everything else. And he was killed on the railroad here in 1927. He was just a young man. He was killed. Of course, my mother. Brothers raised me, and I had never lived with my mother and her husband in second. They never let me in the house. So I was out on my own. I lived. My brother was killed when I was 12, and I lived on my own from then, well, from then on, but up till I was 15 and a half, I just grew up.
Must have been pretty rough to be in Durango and not have a real home.
Pretty tough. I've got some friends that knew about my problems, and my wife knew. Because we were high school sweethearts. Mm-hmm. We should have got married when we were kids, but we didn't. We both married and had a miserable life. And we got together in later years and had 4 happy years. You know, but
just 4 years together.
Then.
40.
And
how many children did you have?
Well, I had 3, and we adopted twin girls. She always wanted twins.
So you had 5 children altogether. Did you have children with your first wife?
That's the 3 I had.
Oh, that's the 3. That's the, and you adopted 2 more with your second wife.
Twins. So she wanted twins, and she got a chance to adopt these twins. They're the ones that live here. That's 10 grandchildren and 1 great grandchild.
That's quite a record. And I suspect you see them all from time to time.
Yeah, my wife just asked me. I couldn't take it. I was in bad shape. I figured I was going to go first, and we had it planned what we was going to do, what to do when I got it, because I had been bad for a long time.
You said you got a heart attack.
Better than I have been for years, and it's a shame. My wife, she was 1,000 times better than I am. Watched all our savings and things disappear and took care of me. We were figuring just not too long before my wife passed away that it cost us somewhere between $250,000 just to get me through my sickness. So we consequently, we spent everything we had saving my life, and then the sweetheart of the 2 of us is the one that died.
Oh.
After losing everything, she had to die, and I'm living. It's a shame.
No,
she was a great woman. She was a great woman.
She could be here too.
She died last winter, and we had a little funeral. So my wife and I both went. Girls wanted to, they had resigned themselves what we wanted, and let her be human. But they just couldn't stand it to have a little bit of a memorial service.
Ceremony.
Yeah, just a little memorial service. And we had it at the hospital, chapel at the hospital. And that's where we should have held it in a big place, because there wasn't enough room. The halls were full of everything. There was a colored lady who lives over in Bayview. She is a her name is Mitty Hearns, and she's the first colored, she was the first colored group that ever sang on television. She sang gospel song, very religious. But she lives in Bayview, Utah. She's the oldest. My wife just thought she was the greatest. My wife and I never went to church. Nothing against it. The kids did. We just didn't, you know. My wife told me lots of times, she says, if you ever have a meeting when you're going to sing these songs, let me know. But she never did. So when Ida died, she'd always told Mitty that she'd like to hear her sing. Mitty used to sing, I belonged to BFW, I was commander for 3 terms. Mitty used to sing a lot of our military funerals. She was a Brazilian, BFW Brazilian. She is a sweetheart. When they had this memorial for my wife, she called me up and she says, Lord, can I sing a couple of songs at your wife?
Oh, that's nice.
I said, I cried.
Yeah, of course.
I said, Mitty, I don't know anything that made Ida happy.
Yeah.
You sing a song. So we went and got her, my daughter, husband and I went out to make a picture of her at the time. And I told Mitty, I says, put your arm in my arm, I'm going to lead you in like a queen, because I think I can put your arm. And I led him into the middle of all those people.
So
she sang 3 songs for my memories. And it was really touching. And then each one of the kids got it. Kids got up and set little individual things, and the nieces and nephews, everybody worshiped idols. I thought the cutest one. They all had cute little things about, say, as growing up. My mother was, my wife was a hero to all of them. I got a nephew that was here, like sister's boy. And he's a grown man. You know, he's a, I call him a kid, but he's a grown man. He got up and he says, you know, he said, I don't know whether I'd ever been like a big grand idol. He says, my mother and father was so excitable that when any little thing go wrong, they just fly up in the air and go all to pieces, and they'd have to go get Ida to calm things up. He says, one day I fell off the porch and broke my leg. They're all standing around there looking at me and wondering what to do, and nobody knows anything to do, and finally one of the kids runs over and tells Aunt Ida, Charlie's hurt, so she come walking out there, and she saw Charlie was hurt, and his leg was all hooked over, you know, by the way she knows to go. She calmly picked him up and carried him across the street to Dr. Mason's house. They lived right across the street from Dr. Mason. That was on West Park. Carried across the street to Dr. Mason's house. He set his leg, he brought her back. She brought him back and put him to bed.
And the rest were just standing around watching.
Just standing around watching. But that was Ida. She was just...
She knew what to do. No, it's still going. Well, shall we call it a day? Have you got any more stories?
Well, I got some more, but you probably get tired of listening to it. I can tell you, now I can go back and tell you a few little things in my life. I told you this when I was growing up without mentioning any names. That out in California, I went, my cousin Ward came down from Oregon, and we went down to Anderson, which was 11 miles below Redding, California, where I was living. And the town is named after this Mr. Anderson. And that's the fellow that my grandfather rode out across the country. You know. And he told me about it and said that they told me how he went across country in there, and they had to live off the land. They didn't have anything, you know. And they lived off the bark of trees and and roots.
Berries.
Berries and stuff. And he was helping us. He fixed the litter and was dragging for a while. And when you get tired of being drugged by it, you get up and hop along on one foot.
Trip.
It was a rough trip, I guess. It was terrible. He didn't know whether, I guess he didn't know whether he was going to live or die for a while. But after he got on board ship, then he was able to get a little more taken care of. He got over to California. The ship pulled into San Francisco. And he got well. He walked back inland. And this Anderson, the town of Anderson, is about, I would say, probably 152 miles from San Francisco, inland, and a little bit further north. Country of Homestead. He's the one that, well, my cousin Ward wrote home and told him about it. And cousin Ward and them all came out in that country and settled. It seems funny, but that's so far away from here that the story jumps from here clear out there.
Yes.
And then back over in here. Now my grandfather's place over in McKenna Canyon just last week. I can't find anything about my dad. My dad, I know, I had a brother called me. And I went to my father's funeral. I got a picture of the funeral. At that time, there was four of us boys left and two girls. One girl and two of those boys in that picture are half brothers and half sisters. There's three of them and three of us left at the time my father died. And my father was 101 when he died. I had lots of chances to acquaint him with that stuff. But it was bitter. I never realized it until later years when my dad knew where I was all the time. But he was afraid and ashamed to come see me. He was afraid I'd disown him. He didn't figure he could stand that. He
couldn't take the rejection.
That's what he felt. So.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this. One of his boys, which was a half brother to me, told me about this. So he's the one that picked me up when I was in San Diego during World War II.
Now, none of those boys or girls are living now? Nobody you can ask?
No relative left. I've got a few nephews and nieces. The ones out in California. They can't tell me. Just haven't got a thing left to go on.
Well, to go back to your service during the war, World War II. Where did you go? You said you
were. Well, I was in the Navy, and I went through the South Pacific, fighting the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I went through Kwajalein and Iwo Jima invasion. Saipan and Tinian, invasion of Saipan and Tinian, then the invasion of Okinawa, not Okinawa, but Guam, and Guam was my last one, and that's where my ship that I was on was sunk during the invasion of Guam, and I was picked up by another ship, and saved, and I was on this other ship. The war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said that ship was a repair ship that picked me up. They sent that ship to China.
How long were you in the water before you were picked up?
The last time I was in there, 14 hours. I figured I was gone.
And were you just floating on a...
I had a little belt jacket, a belt
Oh, a life jacket.
Well, it's called a life belt. It's only about, it's about that wide. It just goes around your waist.
Oh.
And it's got a little tube of gas, you know, that you break the seal and it blows that up.
Oh.
Like an inner tube. Mm-hmm. It gradually leaks off. It was just about leaked off. And it was dark, just getting dark. I've been there all day.
Terrifying.
Yeah, it was. I figured I was gone. I had a chance. And I'd give up. But I'm glad.
Of course. How many years were you in service?
Just 3 years.
3 years.
Okay. 3 years, 10 months, and 11 days.
So almost 4 years.
Yeah. Oh. I signed up just a month to the day. The day was. December the 7th, January the 7th, I missed it. I picked the Navy because I didn't know. It's always, especially my background, the way I got in the middle of stuff. There was no power, I don't think, but I didn't know whether I'd have nerve enough to look a guy in the eye and blow his head. And I still don't think I know. And all I had to do was hesitate just for a second, and he'd blow mine off. So I joined the Navy. At least I didn't have to look him in the eye and blow his head off. And that's honest to God's truth, the reason I joined the Navy. I didn't know whether I'd be capable of looking a guy right in the face and shooting him. I just didn't know whether I'd have it. And I says, I could shoot at that airplane up there in the air. That's it. I could shoot a guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So then when you came out of the service, where did you go?
I came back to Reading, California. That's where I lived when the war started. I lived there after I came back from my service. I lived there until that's when I went to Alaska.
Oh, how long did you stay in Alaska? What did you do there?
Separated. Yeah. I'm not going to hang around.
So you went off to Alaska. I'm just finishing Michener's book on Alaska, so it's a very interesting place to be.
That's where I met that our football coach Sam Roberts. That should be on there too, I guess.
Yes.
I told you about it.
Yeah. Do you want to put that on the tape?
No.
No, I don't think you've talked about him at all.
I went to Alaska, and I got in Alaska, and I went into Fairbanks one day to do some shopping, and I walked into a restaurant in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I sit down at the counter, and I sit down right alongside of a friend from Durango, Colorado, named Herb Clay, that I went to school with.
Small world.
And we sat there and drank coffee, and we got to talking, and Herb says, "Boy, you'd never guess who's up here." And I said, "I haven't any idea." And he says, "Sam Roberts is up here." Sam Roberts was my football coach. Herb played football for him, too.
Here in Durango.
Here in Durango. And he says, "Sam Roberts up here." And I says, "Well, let's go see him." He says, "Well, he's in the gutter down on Skid Row. He's probably asleep in the gutter. No way he'd know you or anything else. He can't do a thing with you."
So strung out on alcohol.
Strictly an alcoholic. And a Skid Row bum. And I just couldn't let it go because I admired Sam Roberts so much. So after Herb left, I went down to Skid Row, and sure enough, I found him down there. I wandered around there, and he was passed out the gutter. Just like Herb said. And I picked him up and got him down and put him in the hotel, Fairbanks Hotel. Got hold of the meal and some coffee and stuff. Gave me a bath, cleaned him up. He was a mess. Stunk. Cleaned him up. I cleaned him up and fed him and stuff. And then I had to go back to work. I lived on 112 miles out in the boondocks, railroad terminal in Fairbanks. I had to go back. So I left a couple of days rent with the clerk down there in case Sam wanted to stay a little longer when he sobered up and come up. He left when he sobered up the next day. When he sobered up, he was sober and he left. And I didn't hear no more of him until after I came back to Durango. This was back in, I think this was back in 48. When I come back to Durango in 1960, along about 63, I imagine, something like that, one day Sam Roberts came back. And he called all the fellas that played football for him on the phone and had a meeting. We went up to what they called Pinkerton at that time. It's up the valley a ways. Used to be a swimming pool, mineral pool, Trimble Springs.
Trimble Springs.
And it was farther on up. There was a college up there for a few years, rich kids' school. But I don't think it's there anymore. It was on the old highway. That was quite a night spot in later years. And in 1960, it was quite a night spot. So that's where we went to have our little reunion with Sam. Was up
Pinkerton.
So there was a fellow up there. The reason he had it there was Sam Roberts, when he was teaching school here coaching football, he lived with a family, and this family had a son that was a blind boy, and he was a musician. He was a blind man, he played the piano, a great musician. I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now. He was pretty famous around the rank, but a good one. And Sam lived with him, and he stayed with him when he was teaching school. That's where he had it up there, where he could be in on it too. So we went up there and we had this meeting. He got up and gave his little talk and told all the football players there how he had got on the booze and just deteriorated, something awful. And he told the truth. You know, he told it right down where he would write down the gutter and skid row. Says, and that's the reason I came back. He said, when I come to the next morning in the hotel and realize that somebody had picked me up and put me in there, maybe the little wheels in my head clicked a little bit. I had no idea what it was. I just knew it had to be one of my football players that did that. Nobody else would have done that. Well, that's the way he felt. And he said, I realized that one of my own kids had done that. He said, I just made up my mind, I was going to get off and got right out and went back to coaching high school football. And I ended up down in Georgia. And he says, I had to prove myself before I had nerve enough to come back and face you. But I won the state championship in Georgia in the last 5 years. I'm a good coach.
Did he ever find out that it was you who saved him?
We're sitting there, and Ed Thompson, who lives here, and used to own Thompson's Saddle Shop. Nice man. One of my best friends. But Ed spoke up and said, don't you really know who found you, Ed? Or
Sam.
Sam said, well, I sure don't, but I know he's in this room. I wish I knew who he was. I know he's in this room. I just know he is. I just feel it. Yes, woke up and he says, well, that was Lord. And then he'd come over and my wife, we brought her wives and stuff like that. And he'd come over there and put his arm around my wife and just with him. He stayed for several days, and every day he'd pick us up and keep us with him all day.
Wow.
He just couldn't understand. But at the meeting, it's going on, and then Sam Roberts was a fellow that he was always helping us. Yes, that was cool. One of his students that was a boy was a fellow named. He became a football coach here later. But Sam had helped him, brought him shoes and stuff. He was so poor, and he was going to school and stuff. And didn't have any family, was poor, and he was doing the Depression. Sam brought him shoes, bought him a pair of football shoes to play football in and stuff like that. Sam was always doing that for his players. You know, he was helping out, buying them little things. Louis Bacoli, do you know him?
No.
He's another one of that age group. He lives here a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Louis spoke up and he says, "Well, Sam," he says, "Sam, why, how come you never did help Bill when he was going to school?" Bill never needed any help. You know, well, I was too proud to let anybody know.
Yeah.
I'd have been better off.
Yeah, he helped, but he helped you in many other ways, didn't he?
Well,
because he was your coach.
He gave me a lot of moral support.
Confidence.
You know, I worshipped him. You know, but I was never a bigger.